All right. What I'd like to look at, you know, normally this time of year, we take a look at Hanukkah. We either have one or two, or sometimes more shiurim on Hanukkah, and we often look at the sugya in Masechet Shabbat. We talk about why it's in Masechet Shabbat, why there's no Masechet Hanukkah, and we look at Mahadrin and Mahadrin Mina Mahadrin. And I want to take a look at something very different, and I want to give thanks and appreciation to a teacher of mine, Professor Schneer Lyman, who years ago gave a shiur on this topic, and I heard it via tape. I didn't hear it live. And I later hunted down a little article he wrote about it. He brought some of these sources, but I've added to it. So some of this is his, some of this is mine, and you know, we'll go from there. The focal point of this is going to be a very bizarre decree that, according to several Midrashic sources, the Greeks decreed at the time of the Hanukkah story. And so I'm going to start with the Rambam. And the Rambam here, when he introduces the laws of Hanukkah, says the following. Bayit Sheni, I'm just going to read the highlighted part. When the Greeks were ruling, Gazru Gzerot al Yisrael, they made decrees against Israel. Uvitlu Datam, they tried to nullify our religion. They didn't allow us to study Torah, to be involved in mitzvot. And then he goes on to the things that the Greeks did, and it includes that they took their money and their daughters. I'm going to keep that in mind. Then, of course, the Hashmonaim came and they rebelled and they beat them and they came in into the Mikdash and they lit Neirot. And then in Halacha Gimel, he says, so the rabbis at that time made a decree that these 8 days, starting on the 25th of Kislev, should be days of rejoicing. And then he says this line, and the wording is very odd. Umadlikin bahem haNeirot ba'erev al pitchei habatim. We light Neirot, we light lamps or candles every evening at the doorway. Now, what you would normally expect is the Rambam would say, and in order to remember this miracle, we light Neirot. How many Neirot do we light? Where do we light them? Who lights them? Etc. Instead, the definition of the mitzvah, not a parameter of the mitzvah, the definition of the mitzvah, the way that the Rambam has it, is that we light these Neirot al pitchei habatim, meaning on the doorways. So what's the significance of the doorway? Why is that so important that it's central to the mitzvah? Okay, that's the background question. And now I want to go to the midrash. Now, what we're looking at in source 2 is a midrash from the very beginning of Bereishit Rabbah, almost the beginning of Bereishit Rabbah. And it's on the second pasuk in the Torah. It's in the second paragraph, because the first section of Midrashim, Parsha Aleph, is very long because the word Bereishit. And on the second pasuk, Va'aretz tohu vavohu, and this midrash is called Midrash Pitaron. Midrash Pitaron means it's a midrash where one or multiple darshanim will look at the pasuk and they'll say that the components of the pasuk refer to a particular, and it's always futuristic, event or series of events. And they'll map out the different pieces of the pasuk as referring to either different individuals or different actions or different locations or whatever. So, for instance, we have a famous Midrash Pitaron when it comes to Yaakov's vision and the ziggurat or the ladder, whatever he saw, and says this is the Beit HaMikdash, and this is our Sinai, and the Malachim Olim V'Yodim Bo, that's Moshe and Aaron, etc. So here we have a Pitaron, we have a few Pitronot to the second pasuk. And I want to look just at the second one, which is Rabbi Shimon ben Lakish, right? And that's the big one. Rabbi Shimon ben Lakish, I mean, big text. Patar Karya b'malchuyot. He said this pasuk is referring to the kingdoms, right? We have other that it refers to different generations, or if it refers to other particular things. Here he says it's about the malchuyot. What are the malchuyot? So Sefer Daniel, which is a treasure trove for Midrashic literature, includes a vision where Daniel sees four wild animals, and these animals represent four kingdoms that are going to enslave or oppress the Jewish people. And that opens up the Midrashic trope of the Arba Malchuyot. We talked about it once. because one of the interpretations in the Talmud Yerushalmi of the Arba Kosot that we drink on Pesach is to correspond to the Arba Malchiot. Shimon Lakish says this pasuk is talking about the Malchiot. Va'aretz hayta tohu zubavel, right? And he quotes a pasuk where the Navi says, "I've seen the land." It's, I think Yechezkel. He says, "And the land is tohu." Vavohu is Madai. Madai is their word for Persia. Madai Paras, because Bavel and Madai, even though they're in the, roughly the same location, they're two very different empires. And Madai now really refers to the Purim story. And the pasuk is Vayavhilu. There's your bohu, midrashically, Lahaviat Haman. It's the Haman story. Not our concern. Our main concern is Choshech. What's the darkness? What's the Choshech? Zu Yavan. That's referring to the Greeks. And by the way, when Chazal speak about the Greeks in this manner, they're usually referring to the Seleucids, the ones who controlled Israel during the second century BCE till Hanukkah, and the ones who oppressed us, etc., Antiochus, right, who are anchored in the town, or the capital was in the town of Antioch. All right, Zu Yavan. What was the darkness of Yavan? Shechshicha enei Yisrael b'gzeroteha. So why are they called darkness? Because they made our eyes dark with their decrees. And this doubles back to the Rambam we opened with about the decrees. Now, we're familiar with some of the decrees that Antiochus made, including a major decree against Brit Milah, where if a baby was circumcised, the baby would be killed, wrapped around its mother's neck, and she was killed also. It was pretty horrific stuff. But notice what it says. Shaita omer l'Yisrael, kitvu b'keren shor she'en lehem chelek b'Elohei Yisrael. What was the decree? You have to write, engrave, on the horn of an ox. Now, this is not a detached horn of an ox. Horn of an ox, that you have no portion with the God of Israel. All right, and that's the Greek decree. And then it goes, al pnei tahom is Rome, and then Ruach Elohim is Mashiach, etc. I'm concerned about this line about the Greeks. Now, you have to admit that this is a very strange statement. I would say Choshech is because they put out the light of the Beit HaMikdash. I could come up with other things. What is this decree that they're talking about? And by the way, it shows up also in Midrash Tanchuma in Parsha Tazria, right? And we have that again, this thing with the four Malchiot, that it talks about the four different appearances of Tzarat represent the four kingdoms, midrashically. And Baheret Zumachut Yavan, where it's highlighted, Shaitam Mivaheret al Yisrael Vomeret Kol Mishi Yeshlo Shor Yechake al Keren Ashor Sheno Chelik Belohe Yisrael Vimlav goes Rina Lav Hariga. So here we hear a slightly expanded version that they made a decree that if you have an ox, you have to engrave on the horn of your ox. By the way, if you have multiple oxen, it doesn't say you have to do all of them. If they engrave on the horn of your ox, I have no portion with the God of Israel, and if not, we're going to kill you. Now, this decree, first of all, is unattested to anywhere else. It's in Midrashic literature. Second thing is, it's a very bizarre decree, you must admit. And so what happens when you have a bizarre decree? People want to figure out what it means. What does this Midrash mean? So we're going to start actually almost at the end, chronologically. Moshe Mirkin wrote a beautiful commentary on Midrash Rabbah, on Midrash Rabbah, in which it's a set, many of you have probably seen it, it's 11 volumes. You have the Midrash with vocalization and punctuation, and underneath a Hebrew commentary with significant and well-researched footnotes, but also that makes it clear and also explains all of the Aramaic words, etc. And he makes the following comment about this decree. They were leitzanim. Leitzanim isn't clowns. Leitzanim is like scorners. There are people who'd tease you. They saw that it was like a sharp chop. What was the sharp chop? So the first thing is that the Greeks are putting in our face our first sin, which was the golden calf. So you have to engrave it on the horn of an ox, almost as if saying that when you made that golden calf all those generations ago, what you were saying is, I have no portion with the God of Israel, right? And then, v'gam lasot le'osei ritzonam sakana. Plus, anybody who would actually fulfill this decree would be in danger. V'kiyum ha'gzeira, It's dangerous to do it. And you have to picture the physical reality, going up to an ox and carving something into it. You're going to get killed. So the Greeks had like a double whammy. First of all, there's an insignificant message here. And second of all, there's also just putting them in danger. The Maharal, in his commentary, Ner Mitzvah, it's a running commentary on Chanukah, beautiful book. In it, he makes the same statement, that it's essentially hitting at the core, at the first major sin that Am Yisrael did as a nation, which was the ego. Okay. There are a number of other approaches. In Otsar HaMidrashim, which was something that Eisenstein published about 100 years ago or less, I think, from Midrashim that were found in different Kitvei Yad, there's a whole section called Midrashei Chanukah. And in it, he says that the Greeks, when they were frustrated because their decrees against religion didn't work, they added a new decree. What was that? Kol Adam Yisrael Sheish Lo Shor Oseh. Now, this is weird because sheep don't have horns, but okay, I guess it probably means a goat. If you have an ox or a goat, Yechakek Al Karnav Shein Lo Chelek Melokei Yisrael. All right, they have to grave it. V'chol Kach Lama. And now we get an explanation. What would the Greeks accomplish with this decree? Jews would no longer eat any meat products because this animal now is dedicated to Avodah Zarah. It's prohibited. So they can't eat the meat from the cow, and they can't drink the milk from the cow, and they can't eat the lamb's meat, and they can't wear wool. The whole thing is prohibited. And they also can't work in the fields because they can't use the bull. It's all asur. So in other words, it's an intricate halachic kind of piece. Now, by the way, that means, of course, that the Greeks are aware of this. Now, that's actually not so difficult because, remember, the Greeks were joined by Jews who became loyal Hellenists. And the main war that existed was not the war of Jews against Greeks, it was Jews against Mityavnim. And so just like happened in the late Middle Ages when Jews were apostates and they helped the church identify texts, etc., that were offensive to the church, you know, that's not so hard to believe. That here they would say, you know what, halachically, according to the Jewish law, if you make them write this on their horn, on the animal, they won't be able to use it. Okay. And then the Jews basically said that, okay, we can't do it. We can't do it. It's very bad. And so they ended up walking barefoot. They didn't have any shoes and they didn't drink any meat and drinking milk and eat meat, etc. Okay. There's a very curious thing, and it took a while to find this, but the Magale Amukot, or Nata Nata Shapira, and Lyman mentions this in this article, develops a whole theme about a relationship between the decree against the Jews, Hanukkah time, as being payback for the sin, and it's very appropriate to Parshat Shavua, the sin of the sale of Yosef. And that's this week. And here he makes the comment, in other words, he says that the decree was that the decree, all the decrees against the Jews and the oppression was a punishment for what we did to selling Yosef. So why a shor? Because Yosef is called the shor, Bechor Shoro Hadarlo. And the idea was that this is a way of reminding us. Now, of course, that means now that the Greeks are very familiar not only with Tanakh and symbolism, or else that the rabbis are creating this to give us this message of the sin of Yosef. As you know, the sin of Yosef sits at the core of the martyrology, which we read on Yom Kippur and on Tisha B'Av about the 10 martyrs, but here also. There's also a commentary, I forgot who said it, who says, don't read the word Keren Hashur, but Keren Hashur, and Hashur is a wall. And the idea is you have to write this on your walls like graffiti. So again, the stranger the comment, the more different commentaries there'll be and the more distinct different commentaries there'll be and wide ranging. Professor Lyman himself made the following suggestion. He said, you know, if you look at the sugya of Yeharik Valyavor of martyrdom and the sugya in Masachet Sanhedrin, a very famous sugya that lists the three crimes for which you have to give your life rather than violate them, stipulates that the fact that it's only three crimes, meaning for Shabbat, you violate Shabbat rather than be killed. A non-Jew comes up to you, puts a gun to your head and says, drive me to the ball game or I'll kill you, then you got to drive him to the ball game. If he says, I want you to violate your Sabbath or I'll kill you, that's a different story. But it hasn't happened lately that I know of. But the Gemara here makes the comment that if it's during the time of persecution, you have to give your life up for anything, even mitzvah kala. What's a mitzvah kala? A light mitzvah. And so Rav says, afilu l'shnuye arkata demesana, even to change your shoelace. Now, what the heck is that? So Rabbeinu Tam here says that they used to have uniquely Jewish sandal straps. And if you change your sandal strap to look like a non-Jewish sandal strap, that's what it was considered. But the Sheiltot, Rav Achai Gaon and the Sheiltot, has a different take on it. He says to bend over in order to change your shoelace, what they would do is they would call the Jew up in front of everybody. There would be an idol sitting there, and they would say, change your shoelace. All right, change your shoelace. What's the big deal? But when you bend over to change your shoelace, it looks to everybody else like you're worshiping the God. And that dovetails with the famous story that we have in a lot of places, including in Masechet Gittin, in the famous selection of, you know, it starts with Kamtza Bar Kamtza, Korban stuff about the woman and her seven children. In some places, she's called Chana, and her seven sons are each brought in succession before the prefect or whoever it is, who says, bow before my idol. It says, I refuse. It says this in the Torah, and he kills him. And finally, when the last kid comes, he says, look, I'm going to throw down my wallet. I want you to pick it up. And it'll look like you're bowing. You don't need to bow. I just need you to look to everybody else like you're bowing. And the kid laughs at the thing. He says, what a chaval you are. What a nebuch you are, that you need me to put on a little show for you, right? And this is something that also shows up in another passage in the Yerushalmi. In the Yerushalmi, they talk about, again, about martyrdom. It's Masechet Shviit. And they give an example of these two brothers, Lulianus and Papus, probably Julian and Papus, who were given by the Romans, were given a water, something to drink in a painted glass to drink. And they refused to do it, and they gave up their life. What would they give their life? So the simplest explanation is that at the bottom of the glass, there was an image of a god. And when they'd raise the glass, they'd be either worshiping it. So what all of these sources have in common, to kind of tie it together, is that there was a notion and we know that this was prevalent, certainly during the early Roman era, where in order to sort of break the will of the Jewish community, they would try to get a Jewish leader to publicly accept paganism. And when they couldn't actually get them to accept it, they would say, put on a show as if. And so the suggestion is that that's what the Greeks were doing by marking on this horn of the animal that, right, it's like a public a statement. Well, you don't believe it. They know you don't believe it, but it's a public statement. And that was this terrible decree. However, and that's as far as Professor Lyman's piece goes. However, elsewhere in this Otsar HaMidrashim, there's a bit of an expansion, and I want to end with this. I'm going to take us till 1:30-ish, but I want to end with this. I'm not going to read this whole piece; it's long, but I want to start. Tanu Rabbanan, and it's presented as if it's a braita. Bimei Machut Yavan Rasha'a Gazul Yisrael Shekol Mi Sheishto Bariach Betoch Beito. Now watch, this is an expanded version. They decreed that if you have a bolt on your door, you know, you have a door and you have a bolt that comes down, Yachkok Alav She'ein L'Sonei Yisrael, that's a euphemism for Jewish people when they're not doing right, Chelek B'Nachalav Elo Yisrael. Right on your door, basically, I have no portion with the God of Israel. What happened? Miyad Hachu Yisrael V'akru B'Rechim Shebateim. So what happens? The Jews took the bolts off their doors. So the Greeks are going to tell me I have to write something vile on my... I'm not going to do it. V'od gazru shekol mi sheyesh lo shor yichtov al karno she'en l'sonei Yisrael, chelek b'nei Yisrael. The next one was on your axe. So the ox is part of a series in this. Right? What happened? Halchu Yisrael machru shor, and they sold all of their oxen. Now, I'm not concerned with the historicity of this story. I'm concerned with the literary history of it. The od gazru aleihem shiu bo'alim l'shem nidot. They made a decree that they had to have relations when their wives are nida. Now, I'm not sure how that last one's enforceable at all. Right? But, again, it is what it is. Halchu Yisrael parshumi l'shem. This is like the agadot about Amram and Yocheved, right? That the men all separated from their wives. So I'm not going to have a relationship with my wife when she's a nida. Separate from my wife. Beod Gazru. Are you ready? Shekol Mishin Osei Isha Tiba'el Hegmon Tchila. This is Prima Nocta, which we're familiar with from other oppressions that we've been in, that anybody who gets married, first she has to have relations with the local hegemon, with the local governor, right? And this, by the way, was what led in to the custom that goes back several hundred years, I believe, to women shaving their head, you know, to make themselves very unattractive, so the guy wouldn't want to do it, right? The Chatam Sofer. In any case, what happened? Then she can go back to her husband. This lasted for 3 years and 8 months. Now, who gets married? The daughter of the Kohen Gadol is about to get married. Now, this story is wild. We didn't hear this in high school. They wouldn't have told us in high school. So what happened? This is the daughter of the Kohen Gadol. And now they're going to bring her before her wedding to the Hegmon's house for one night. Para'arosha, what did she do on the way? And by the way, this is Matityahu's family, right? This is, it sounds like it's Matityahu's sister, perhaps. Or maybe daughter. Para'arosha, she undid her head, her hair, undid her hair. Kar'abgadeha, she ripped her clothes. V'amda aruma b'fne'am, she stood there naked. Whether it's naked or means without her, but she stood in front of everybody like that. Miyad nitmale Yehuda ve'echav chema aleha. So Yehuda and his brothers got enraged at her. Ve'amru otziu al yisrefa. And they wanted to have her burnt, like a bat kohen who had znut. V'ayit galed davar zela machub neshakarat nefashot. And by the way, we can't tell anybody because they'll kill us. Now notice, who's painted here as the wimp? Yehuda, Hamakabi. Who's painted here as the heroine? This daughter who strips herself rather than going to this guy. She'iza panel liot aruma b'fnei kol amazeh. And this is going to endanger us because the hegemon is going to be very angry. He's going to come kill us. All right. And by the way, this is the story of where Hanukkah starts, according to this version. Azam Ralo. We are familiar with the story of Matityahu and the pig and the mizbeach. And, right? So this is a different one. Azam Ralo, hey, ach et bazel ifne achai v'rei'ai. So as you're concerned, she says to Yehuda, that I'm being embarrassed in front of my own family and my friends. Lord bazel b'nei arel u'tamesha atam rotzim lim'ol bi lichoti lishkav etzlo. And you think it's not shameful that you're bringing me to sleep with him? She is putting it to them. Kevan sheshama Yehuda v'chavirav kach, when Yehuda and his fellows heard this, no, atsuyachtav larog agmon. They decided they're going to go. They're going to kill the governor. Miyad hilbishu on arad, and they put clothes on her. Bilvush malchut with royal garments. Basu chupa shel hadas mibeit chashmonai ad beito shel agmon. They made a chuppah procession all the way to his house, as if they're going to bring her there. Uva'in kol balei naval v'chinor balei zemer. All the musicians were there. Yuma zamrim rakdim ad shabal lebeit agmon. They came to the house. The Egmon heard this. Look at this. These Jewish people are the descendants of Aaron HaKohen. Look how happy they are to do my will. They're bringing their sister to me to sleep with her. Isn't that nice? They deserve great honor. So he said, the honor is, I'm going to meet with them privately, let Yehuda and his sister come in, and his friends, and then they cut off his head, and then the rest, you know, the war starts there. Now, what you find here in this particular telling of the story is that, first of all, Chanukah is not presented as an uprising against oppressors who have taken our land. That's true. But it's presented here as a war of religious liberation from oppressors who continue to push down on us and threaten us with death unless we publicly state we have no part with the God of Israel. So how does the Rambam define the mitzvah of Chanukah? Madlikin neirot al petach al pitchei batim. We light neirot outside of our door. In other words, Chanukah is a demonstration. Chanukah is a public statement. But now, I've got to add one more thing. What How do we celebrate this? So it's a very interesting thing, is that if you look in all the sugyot, we've done this in the past, all the sugyot about Hanukkah, nearly all of them are Babylonian. Nearly all of them are Babylonian, including very likely the rule that you light Neirot outside of the house. Now, why is that significant? Because in the year 227, the Parthian Empire crumbled and the Sasanian Empire became empowered. And they elevated to positions of power the Zoroastrian priests, who are called the Chabari. And these Chabari had up and down, but unlimited rights, like sometimes stronger, sometimes less, but unlimited rights to enforce their will on the people. And one of the things they had was an aversion to allowing anybody else to have a flame outside of their house if it was one of their festivals. Rashi mentions this in his commentary on the Gemara. The Gemara here in source 16 says Rav was asked the question on Shabbat, if it's Shabbat Chanukah and you have the Ner Chanukah lit, are you allowed to move it out of the way while it's lit on Shabbat? Super Muktzah, are you allowed to move it out of the way if one of the Chabarim is coming? Ma'u l'tutule shraga v'chanukta mikame Chabari b'shabta. The Zoroastrians had fire as a major component of their religion, and preventing us from having fire to represent our celebration. I'd like to perhaps just suggest maybe a little bit the possibility that the rule about lighting Ner Chanukah outside the house was directly a statement against their oppression, was directly a statement of saying, we are in the footsteps and in the shadows of the Maccabim, who took the decree of the Greeks to publicly state that we are giving up our faith in God and our connection to God, and we fought against that, and we're doing the same thing today. And as a result of that, we're dafka putting a lamp, and we're putting it outside the house as a statement of Jewish pride, as a statement of your inability to crush us, to crush our spirit, and to crush our fidelity to God. And what we find in these midrashim, it goes back to this decree about the Keren Ashor. It's really part of a larger series of decrees in which Jews were being told to publicly state, we are recanting, we are denying we're renouncing our allegiance to God, and we refuse to do it. And it was actually this heroic woman who is, if you think about it, something of an echo of the Yehudit. The Judith story sounds a lot like this. It involves several of the same components, including with the guy with no head at the end of the story. And so I'd like to suggest that maybe that's what sits behind not only the rule of lighting outside, but the Rambam's wording, Madlikim Amneirot Ba'erah Pitchei Batim, the definition of the mitzvah is it for to be outside your door. And the Rambam therefore introduces the whole story of Chanukah not with the encroaching on the Beit HaMikdash and the liberation of the Mikdash, but rather with the terrible decrees that they decreed and the uprising that followed. So just another way to look at the story, which is, thank God, rich in history and rich in story.